Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the house of the Lord. It's so good to see each of you here today. We're continuing in our series of messages. This year, my intention is to take us through the whole Bible as kind of an overview. Obviously, we're not going to get into the nitty-gritty of every single thing in the Bible, but hopefully we'll get a big picture view of the Bible and have a good sense of how it all kind of hangs together, and hopefully have a framework upon which to build a whole lot of other biblical knowledge. But I am convinced that the Bible message is a message of rescue. I've titled the whole series, The Great Rescue. And I want you to understand that the Bible is not just a resource for you to gather information. It is a very living and real thing that God has put before us and something God is using to find us. The Bible and being found by God is kind of the subtitle I've added to our series this year. So let me start off today by admitting that life is hard. I was raised with the teaching that a husband was to be the leader of the household. So when I was first married, my assumption was that it was my job to make decisions and Ellie's job to follow them. I learned, though, through the years, that there are some areas I'm not great at making decisions in. Areas, by God's grace, in which my wife is amazing. She has wisdom in areas that I like. And I have learned through the years that things go much better for us when we actually consult with each other and make decisions together. We struggled for years to find the right balance in our own marriage, to choose not to fight for dominance, but to actually work together. Other things about life are difficult. We have struggled often in our life to provide for ourselves. We have found ourselves in situations where the only car we could afford was a piece of junk, and having to drive it long distances to get to work, never sure if we were going to make it to work or back. Back in the days before we had cell phones, and where being stranded by the side of the road was a whole lot different than it is today. We've faced losing jobs when we really couldn't afford to lose them. Forging a path in this world is riddled with anxiety, and often a fruitless labor in the work we do. Why is this life so hard? Well, God explains why in today's passage. So I have titled our message today, Our Broken World. We're in Genesis chapter 3, beginning in verse 9, and we're picking up where I left it off in my last message. In my last message, we ended with the first humans choosing to disobey God and eating from the tree that was forbidden. And the immediate reaction is the destruction of the two core relationships in their existence. They are now no longer safe with each other. For the first time, they experience what it is to feel naked and exposed and to feel the need to cover up from each other. And then when they hear the sound of God in the garden, for the first time ever, their instinct is to run away and hide. Their communion with each other, their communion with God is shattered. And that's where we pick up the story here in verse 9. Now, we might expect that humans have done what God said they shouldn't do, and He warned them, the day you do this, you're dead. So we might expect that the next moment in this narrative is God showing up to kill them. That's what He told them would happen. That's the consequence He said there would be. The day you eat of it, you're dead. That's not the way the story plays out, though. Verse 9. But Yahweh God called to the man and said to him, "Where are you?" So rather than show up and destroy, God calls out to the man. Now, here's the interesting thing. Obviously, God knew exactly where he was. God knows everything. He didn't need to run around finding Adam. And this idea, this image of God walking in the garden and making sound and doing this in the cool of the day, the breeze of the day, this is just a way to put into language we can wrap our heads around that initially humans and God had an easy communion. It was as easy as walking in the breeze of the day in a garden with a friend. That's how close humans were to God. In the beginning. And that has been broken. Now all of a sudden, when God approaches, humans flee. Humans seek to distance themselves. But rather than show up and destroy, God continues to pursue. Even though he knows they've already ruined everything. He doesn't give up on them. He calls out, "Where are you?" And he's giving the man an opportunity to interact with him. Even though currently he's trying to run away, God is pursuing after him. Verse 10, and he said, "I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, and I hid myself." So the first justification Adam provides for running away from God is, "I felt like it. I know I'm naked. I felt exposed. I was afraid, so I hid." It's interesting that I think even to this day, that's often the only justification some people provide for their distance from God. "Yeah, I've done stuff wrong, and I have turned my back on God, and I have done things that have created within me this sense of shame, this sense of wrongness, and a sense of unworthiness. So I have no interest in drawing near to God because what I feel is a desire to run away from God." And that is the only justification provided for their distance from God. "I don't feel like being close to God." And that's kind of the worst approach. When we do something wrong and the reactions we immediately have to what we've done wrong point us away from anything good and deeper into something bad, the worst thing we can do is to follow those inclinations further in. So just saying, "I don't feel like drawing near to God because it makes me feel bad. It makes me feel sinful. It makes me feel like I've done stuff I shouldn't do. And I don't want to think about that, so I'll just ignore God altogether." That's not an excuse. Just because you feel like it isn't a justification. And sadly, we live in a world where we're told just that. If you feel like it, it's automatically good. Whatever you want to do, that's your truth. As though you were God. And you could declare truth into existence. God continues in verse 11, and he said, "Who told you that you were naked? Never seemed to bother you before, Adam. You were never afraid of me before. In fact, you weren't naked. You didn't have any clothing, but you weren't naked." What do you mean, naked? "Have you eaten from the tree from which I commanded you not to eat?" And God knows. God knows the answer to the question. And your parents know this. Have you ever tried to give your children the chance to come clean? And you point blank ask the question you already know the answer to, hoping, take the opportunity, just fess up to what you did. Let's get this done better than it could be. God gives Adam the chance to just admit, "Did you do this?" God already knows the answer, but God is still pursuing relationship, even though sin is now in the middle of that. Verse 12, and the man said, "The woman whom you gave to be with me, she gave to me from the tree, and I ate." So basically, Adam answers, "Yes, I ate, but it's not my fault." there are two other people I can blame. God, there's this woman you gave me. If you had given me a kind of woman that wouldn't have done this, none of this would have happened. But because you gave me this woman, and then, of course, because this woman took from the tree and gave it to me, that's why I ate. I want you to understand that this approach to sin has been around since it first started. From the very beginning, we humans have wanted to ignore our own responsibility for what we have done. And the way we try to do it is to blame anybody but ourselves. And it's very common today. Nothing you do is your fault. It's your mom's fault. It's your dad's fault. It's your church's fault. It's society's fault. It's the systemic powers that have oppressed you's fault. But it's not your fault, even though you're the one that did it. How does that work? And Adam tries this. Yeah, I ate from the tree, but it's not my fault. You gave me this woman, and this woman gave me the tree, gave me from the tree, and that's why it happened. Of course, Adam didn't have to eat it. All he had to do was say no thanks. So, let's see what the woman has to say. And Yahweh God said to the woman, "What is this that you have done?" I don't think the woman has any idea what just happened. But God knows. God can see through the millennia of horror what lies ahead. Tortures and rapes and cruelty and war and bloodshed and hatred. He sees all of it. What have you done? You have condemned humankind to the horrors of a world under the power of sin and death. The woman takes a cue from her husband and says, "The serpent deceived me and I ate." Again, it's the serpent's fault. He lied to me. He told me something that wasn't true, and I believed him and ate it. You know why that excuse doesn't work either? Because before the serpent said anything, God told her the truth. And she had to decide, will I trust God or will I trust the serpent? And she chose to trust the serpent. Now, why did she make that choice? Well, here's the reason people to this day follow false teachers. Because they know what you want to hear. The serpent told Eve, "You can be like God. You can be as powerful as God." And that appealed to Eve. And just the same way today, these false teachers who peddle a false message and abuse and take money from thousands and thousands of people, why do people follow them? It's not because they're telling them the truth. It's because they're telling them what they want to hear. They are selling a message that promotes a selfish pattern of living. You can live for yourself. You can live focused inward. And I will promise you health and wealth and ease and power and prestige if you would just follow me. And people say, "Yeah, I want all of that. I want to live selfishly. I don't want to talk about giving up my own rights. I don't want to die to myself. I don't want to take up a cross. I don't want to put God first. I want to put me first. So I will follow you, false teacher, because I like what you're selling." You think you can come before God and say, "No, this guy lied to me." God didn't lie to you. There is truth available to you. Why don't you listen to God? So just saying somebody lied to me does not get you off the hook. We believe what we choose to believe. And if our motivation in belief is selfish, we can't pawn it off on the person who lied to us. We should have known better. Something within says, that's not the right motivation. That's not right. And we ignore the conscience that God speaks into our hearts and follow the liars because we want to hear that message. The serpent deceived me, and I ate. I'm going to point out, God confronts the man. He confronts the woman. He does not confront the serpent. I told you in my last message, I think we often misunderstand the nature of Satan. We anthropomorphize Satan and think he is kind of like us. He isn't. First of all, there's no indication he's a physical being. He seems to operate in the spiritual world, seems to have some ability to have influence in spiritual and intellectual ways. But beyond that, there's no physical body. He also apparently is still around thousands and thousands of years later. None of us is still around thousands and thousands of years later. So there are very key ways in which Satan is nothing like us. I think one of those ways is that Satan was created, I believe, as a being without agency. We were. I think we were the only beings created with the right to choose good or evil. I don't think Satan was created that way, which is why I think God does not confront the serpent. Because the serpent did nothing other than what it was created to do, which was put Adam and Eve to the test. Argue the opposite point. And it did its function as it was supposed to. Now, Adam and Eve could have rejected that and chosen life, but they didn't. But there's nothing to confront in the serpent because the serpent, I believe, Satan, I believe, was not a being with agency. And yet, there are consequences. And when God confronts the consequences, he will do it in inverse order. We went from Adam to Eve, and she pointed to the serpent. Now we're going to start with the serpent and then work to the woman and then work to the man. Verse 14, then Yahweh God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all the cattle and above any wild animal of the field. Upon your belly you will go, and dust you will eat all the days of your life. So now that humans have introduced sin into creation, God turns to Satan. I believe the serpent is a representation in this narrative of Satan. He turns to the serpent and says, because of your role in all of this, you now fall under a curse. There's no indication that the serpent was cursed before this moment. But now that sin is a reality, there is a special level of curse that falls upon Satan. In fact, it's above and beyond the way the curse of sin affects all the cattle or any other wild animal of the field. And that is an indication, and as we get to when God starts talking to Adam, we get to the point where all of creation falls under this curse of sin, and it affects all of creation, but it's going to affect Satan in a uniquely egregious way. His curse is going to be a bigger deal than the curse that falls on any other aspect of creation. And as a way to represent this visually, on your belly you'll go, and dust you will eat all the days of your life. And these images point to him being a base and denigrated being. And in antiquity, eating dust was the language they associated with death. The dead and it makes sense. You die, you're buried, you're laid in the dirt of the earth, and you eat dust. So it was associated, that image of eating dust was associated with what the dead do. So Satan will come to fall under a powerful curse, will be denigrated, and will be closely associated with death. Verse 15, and I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and her offspring. He will bruise your head and you will bruise his heel. Now, God says to the serpent, now you're not just going to be there to test. Now you are going to be the enemy. And it's at this point that Satan becomes the fearsome adversary. so that it's no longer simply a test, a fairly administered test to choose between good and evil, but now with any dirty trick that he can throw into it and any cruel intent, there will be an intentional pursuit of utter devastation and destruction for humankind. Both the serpent, both Satan and his offspring, and I think that's just a way of referring to the spiritual forces that are aligned with evil, what we would call demons. And there's going to be this adversarial reality. There are now going to be spiritual beings at work in the world who are intentionally seeking to destroy humans. And that war has been raging ever since. And occultism and darkness and forces of darkness have been something humans have been battling since the very beginning. And to this day it continues. All these evil dark forces that are at work around us and that are trying to absorb and destroy humankind. This word offspring is in the singular. And it can be a singular that represents a totality, but it can also be a singular that represents a single individual. So offspring, I think in this ambiguous usage, I think is intentional because there are two ways in which this enmity is going to play out. Satan and all who belong to him are going to be battling Eve and all of her family of humankind. But there's also a singular face-off between Satan and one offspring of Eve. There is a moment, and it's this image is given of a human trying to stomp on the head of a serpent to kill it, and the serpent managing to envenom and kill the human by striking at his heel. And God says both of these things are going to happen. I think this is a very veiled reference that only makes sense in retrospect once Christ has come. But there's this image that there will be a descendant of Eve who will succeed in crushing the head of the serpent, even though he himself will be struck in the heel by the venomous serpent. And it is true that Jesus, a descendant of Eve, came into this world. God himself came into this world in human flesh, and he faced off with this adversary, this great enemy of ours, and he did taste death. And yet he rose in victory over sin and death and definitively crushed the head of the serpent. So I think we have here a veiled hint of hope to what lies ahead. Obviously, it's not fleshed out in any way. But we have the first indication that sin is a huge problem, but God is already has a plan of what he's going to do about it. I will point out also that Satan in the Bible is not described as a being like us. He's never given a name. He's only ever described in terms of function. The word Satan means enemy or adversary. In fact, when you're translating both from the Hebrew and the Greek and you run across the word Satan, you have to look at the context to figure out whether we're talking about what we would call Satan or just some enemy, a human enemy, because it's the exact same word. And the word devil means, some people would say liar, but it's worse than that. It's slanderer. Somebody who not only accuses, but does so unfairly. Now God turns his attention to the woman, verse 16. To the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbearing. You will bear children in pain, and your desire will be directed to your husband, but he will rule over you. So, to the woman, God says that the pain of childbearing, literally it's pregnancy and birthing are the two terms used. But that there will be pain involved that was not part of the process earlier. Now, we can speculate, does that mean that back then originally. Giving birth to children was not painful at all. I'm not sure if that's what it means. I do believe, looking at the totality of what God is saying here, that we're not just talking about physical pain. We're not just talking about how painful it is to give birth to a child. Because he ties that in the same sentence to her desire that draws her to her husband, from which this union occurs that results in pregnancy and childbirth. And the fact that this husband she's going to desire is actually going to rule over her. So I think the pain we're talking about here is much more than just the pain of giving birth to a child. It's the pain of rearing children in this world in the context of a family structure that at the very top is already compromised. In the context of a family structure in which there's already a power struggle happening between husband and wife. And the odds are stacked against us raising these children. I bet I could ask any mother here who has grown children, was the moment you gave birth the most painful moment you experienced with this child? Or have there been different kinds of pain afterward that you would gladly go back and do the other one again rather than that? Bearing and raising children in this world is a painful experience. It'll break your heart. It's hard. And not only that, but it's going to be born of this genuine, God-given, good desire that draws us to each other. But even though we have this good desire to be drawn together and to form a family together and to raise children together, there is also this abuse of power that takes place. Because now your husband that you are drawn to in love to bring children into this world, this husband is going to rule over you. He is going to exercise dominion over you. This is the same language used to describe how Adam and Eve were to treat the rest of creation. They were to govern and rule and subdue the rest of creation. Before sin, they were not told to do that with each other. They were equal participants in ruling the cosmos. But what happens now? And here's the great irony. You know why Eve ate the fruit? Because the serpent told her, "You will be like God." You see, she was already like Adam. She was equal to Adam, but she wanted to be more than Adam. She wanted to be as powerful as God. The great irony here of the deception is that now that sin is in the world, Eve is going to find herself at a disadvantage. You see, before having more muscle and higher stature and greater strength did not translate into abuse. It translated into a greater capacity for service. Now that sin is a part of the picture, greater strength translates into an ability to impose your will on somebody else. Women know this. They move through this world with the knowledge from the time they're children that there are any number of men around them that, given the opportunity, could impose their will on them. They're stronger. And this doesn't happen in every single comparison, but statistically and generically, men have more muscle mass and have greater strength and can have the physical ability to impose themselves on women. And the whole story of the human race is the sad story of how the strong have imposed their strength and their will on the weaker. And the plight of women through the whole history of humankind is confirmation of this curse described right here. The weak have been at the mercy of the powerful. And what should have been a joining of equals, one flesh, now becomes a power struggle. And the woman is going to get the short end of the stick on that one. Verse 17. And to Adam he said, because you heeded the voice of your wife and ate from the tree about which I commanded you, saying, you shall not eat from it. Cursed is the ground because of you. Remember Adam's defense? This woman you gave to me, and I ate. God corrects Adam. Here's the problem, Adam. It's not that I gave you this woman. It's not that she gave you something to eat from the tree. It's that you chose to listen to her rather than to me, because I told you, don't eat it. And you had to decide, am I going to obey God, or am I going to do what Eve is telling me to do? And you, Adam, chose to do what you wanted to do. Don't try to blame me. Don't try to blame Eve. You did what you wanted to do. I told you not to eat from it. And you disregarded me and heeded the voice of your wife. That's why you are culpable. We need to learn to stop trying to blame everybody else for what we have freely chosen to do. It's nobody's fault but the one who did it. Because of this, the ground itself is now cursed. In anxious toil, you will eat from it all the days of your life. What God is describing here, I think the Apostle Paul fleshes out for us when he's in the letter to the Romans describing the gospel, this good news of how God is making right all that sin has made wrong, and how he is doing that in response to faith in Christ Jesus, how that opens up the floodgates for God's righteousness to come in where the wrongness of sin has been before. And he's talking about all this. He gets to chapter 8 and he says, let me explain how this ties into the whole rest of creation. What Christ is doing with us ties into the rest of creation. Verse 19, chapter 8. For creation awaits with eager expectation the revealing of God's sons. And Paul has talked about how Christ has promised a day of his appearing in which all the dead will be raised to face judgment, and those who have had faith will be raised to immortal glory, and we will have new heavens and new earth. That's what he's talking about. Right now, creation awaits with eager expectation the revealing of God's sons. For creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of the one who subjected it in hope, so that creation itself will also be set free from slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of God's children. For we know that all creation groans and suffers pain together up to the present. Paul is saying, when humans sinned, because humans were the crowning moment in creation, God created humans as the beings created in his image and likeness with whom he would share governance of all creation. So when these beings, whose purpose was to be image and likeness of God in creation, when they fell under the power of sin, the whole rest of the created order went along with them. Creation itself came to be broken. And here is a common pagan thought that is false, that nature in and of itself is pure and righteous and good. Nature itself is tainted. Nature itself is broken. Nature itself is also under the curse of sin. And some people observe that there are expressions of things that are not right that have nothing to do directly with human actions. And that's a valid point. And that's because the curse of sin has affected everything in the world. And sometimes children are born with deformities or abnormalities. That's not the way it was intended to be. But sometimes it just happens because we live in a world that is tainted. And it's not that somebody sinned directly that caused that particular thing to happen, but nature itself is broken. And this idea that Mother Nature is all wise and all good, and our responsibility is to submit to her. We're trying to deify the creation we were created to govern. It's completely backwards. So Mother Nature is not the good God we should be submitting ourselves to. There is a good God we need to submit to, but it's not Mother Nature. It's the God who spoke everything into being. But now that the ground is cursed, work is going to become... Remember, God told them to work already. But now work is going to become very different. Anxious toil is the way God describes it. Not just a little bit, all the days of your life. It will sprout thorn and thistle for you, and you will eat the plant of the field. So he describes the plight of the person who devotes himself to agriculture. And you try to get the best seed together, and you till the ground, you work it, and you pick the right time of year, and you plant your seed, and you baby it in tender care, and do everything you can for it, and up comes your plant, and what else comes up? Right next to it, all kinds of stuff you didn't plant. Weird plants that you can't eat. And not only you can't eat them, but they're noxious. They scratch you and abrade your skin and make your life miserable. You're going to fight every day of your life to get this earth to produce what you need it to produce. And I think any person who's devoted himself to agriculture can understand what God is describing here. That anxious eye on the horizon, what's the weather going to be like? Is the freeze going to come too soon? Is the rain going to come too late? Will some horrible thing happen that will throw away a year's worth of work? No sense of certainty, no sense of rest, but anxious toil. By the sweat of your brow you will eat bread until you return to the ground, for from it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you will return. So you're going to struggle your whole life long, anxiously fighting to provide. And here's what's going to happen in the end. You're going to be engaged in a life and death struggle with this earth to get what you need to live. And guess who's going to win in the end? The ground. Because one day, no matter how well you do it and how successful you are in your endeavors, one day your body is going to give out on you and you are going to be returned to that ground. And guess who will have the last laugh? That very ground you spent your whole life fighting with. God rose you up out of the dust of the ground to make you this glorious being. You'll go back to becoming nothing but dust. And the earth will win. So here's the downside to being stronger. Yes, stronger means you get to impose your will on the weaker. It also means that when everyone is scraping and trying to provide, if you're stronger and you get out in the fields and you can accomplish more, then the burden of provision is going to fall more heavily on you. Because you know, if you don't do it, your wife's not going to be strong enough to pull that plow. And if you don't get out there and sweat and you put that strength to work trying to provide, it's not going to happen. A couple of things I'd like to say about this. I often hear people say when they're talking about this passage that what God is doing here is punishing Adam and Eve for their sin. But if you look at it carefully, there are only two things in all of this that God says he is doing. He says, I will put enmity between the serpent and the woman. And he says, I will greatly increase the pain in pregnancy. So those are two direct things that we could say, yes, that God is pointing this out as something he's doing, and you could say that's a punishment. But everything else God has said, he doesn't say, I'm doing this. He just says, this is the way it is. And I think more than God meting out punishment, what we have here is God explaining to Adam and Eve, this is what the world is going to look like now that sin is in the world. And it isn't God punishing, it's that is what sin does. Sin destroys, it erodes, it eats away at everything good and tries to bring it to dust. Why do I say that's important? Well, if everything here were a punishment, then we basically would have to say, well, that's what God said, we've just got to suck it up and accept it. But I think if we look at all of this, I think we would all agree this is not at all what God intended. God is not describing his vision of what he wants the human race to look like. And sometimes people even have the audacity to look at these verses and try to turn them into commandments, like the idea of a husband ruling over his wife is a commandment issued by God. No, that is a consequence of sin. God doesn't want marriage to be a power struggle. That's something we make of it. And God doesn't want our lives to be devoted to anxious, fruitless toil. He wants our lives to be devoted to productive, meaningful engagement that results in affecting eternity. He wants our lives to have significance. So what we have here is not commandments. It's a description of this is what sin is doing with your life, and it should be something that motivates us to turn away from all of that to find redemption and rescue in God. So that our life is not eaten up by anxious and pointless toil. So that our family life is not marked by a constant battle for dominion. These things are not what God wants. They're what happens because sin is here. I will also make an observation. You might observe that if the pain of raising children and bearing children and being married is described as a new difficult situation for the wife, surely we can admit that that also happens to the husband, right? I've been hurt in the process of raising children. I've experienced pain. And I have been involved in this struggle for dominion within marriage, and I have suffered the negative consequences of that struggle. It isn't just the woman who suffers these things. And the whole idea of how working hard and trying to provide for yourself and feeling like you're Sisyphus pushing that stupid rock up a hill every day only to see it roll down every single day. Why can't I ever get ahead? That doesn't just happen to men, it happens to women too. There are single moms who bear that burden ridiculously bad. It isn't a gender delineated thing that only affects one or the other. It affects all of us in one degree or another. Verse 20, the man named his wife Eve because she would be mother to all those who live. Eve means living or life giver. So what we have now is the first expression of the husband's dominion over his wife. Before, man was given the instruction to name all the creatures on earth because he was given dominion over the earth. Man and woman were given dominion over the whole earth. Now, Adam is exercising dominion over his wife, and naming her is one way of doing that. He didn't turn around and say, now you give me a name. And Yahweh God made for Adam and his wife tunics of skin and clothed them. There's both a positive and a negative in that. Positive in that God gave them better clothes, and it's an act of kindness on his part to provide them leather clothing. The sad part is they're going to need it. The world they are moving into now is a hard world, and fig leaves are not going to cut it. But God shows his willingness to still provide and still be involved. And Yahweh God said, "Behold, the man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And now, lest he extend his hand and take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever." God never finishes his thought. In his following actions, we can see what he does to resolve that concern. This is another example of God speaking in the plural. We saw it in chapter 1, verse 26. Now, some people insist these are examples of God addressing a heavenly council of beings. I would point out that neither of these passages mention anybody but God. So I don't think we have to go outside these passages to find that heavenly council and insert it here. I think it's much easier to assume that God is using the plural as a way of conveying his great majesty. But that God is basically speaking to himself. We have an internal deliberation within the Godhead. The man has become like one of us, knowing good and evil. And that verse has always bothered me. Because everything I've observed, when they ate from the tree, they became less like God, not more like God. Before, they were sinless. They knew no shame. They were perfectly good in every way, and everything about their existence was good. In all of those ways, they were like God. But when they ate, they experienced the sense of nakedness, shame, fear. All of that to me says they were less like God, not more like God. So why does God say, "Oh, now they have become like us, knowing good and evil"? Again, even that knowing good and evil is different. They knew evil by having practiced it. God didn't know evil that way. So in what sense have they now become more like God? And I believe what God is pointing to here is the fact that now the human being has exercised agency. Remember, in all creation, God only created humans with the ability to make a choice between good and evil. And having exercised that choice, they now became free beings who have freely made their choice. In the same sense that God is a free being who has freely made his choice. And you might say, "No, God can't sin. God can't be tempted by evil." Really? I thought he spent 40 days in the desert being tempted. Didn't he? And I don't think he was play acting. I think it was a genuine choice, just like Adam and Eve faced in the garden. I think Jesus, when God became a man and subjected himself to the limitations of a human life and lived this life among us as a human being, and he faced the tempter the same way Adam and Eve did, not the same way. Now he's the accuser, the slanderer, the enemy. He is corrupted and cursed and is much a worse thing than Adam and Eve faced, but he faced him. And God himself exercised the free agency of a free being and chose not to sin. But in the sense of becoming beings who have exercised free agency, now humans are like God in that. Of course, they used it to do the opposite of what God used it to do. But now God says, we cannot allow this being to live forever. We cannot allow him to extend and take hold of this representation in the garden of the potential for eternal living. You cannot eat from the tree of life. Verse 23 says, So Yahweh God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to work the ground from which he had been taken. And he drove the man out, and he placed east of the Garden of Eden cherubim and a whirling flaming sword to guard the way to the tree of life. So humans were cast out of Eden. And the path to return to Eden was guarded by cherubim and a flaming sword. You might wonder, what are cherubim? I have a couple of photos here. I have an example of an Assyrian version of cherubim. That's an Assyrian couple of cherubim. What does an Egyptian cherub look like? A sphinx. These are composite mythological creatures, and their function in the mind of the ancients was they were guardians. And they were set up to guard access to something sacred or special or important, something that people should not be allowed to just waltz into. What I think we find here is one possible indication, and you may disagree with me. If you do, God bless you, go ahead. But one possible indication that in these early chapters of Genesis, what we have is creation narrative where imagery is used to convey truth. But the whole idea of Eden being this specific garden and that its access is guarded from the east by these mythical beings and this flaming, twirling sword, I would suggest that this is symbolic language, simply to say that when sin became a part of human existence, God said, I'm not going to allow humans to live forever. This is a way of visually telling us that truth. But it could be, I don't know, people are doing it. They're using satellite imagery and trying to figure out what the two rivers that we can't find are and where we've got the Tigris and the Euphrates, but who knows what the other two rivers are, and they try to calculate. But we've got drones, we've got satellites, we've got helicopters. You could come in from the west today. Nobody has found the garden. Nobody has found cherubim. Nobody has found a flaming sword. I think what we have here is symbolic language to convey truth. And I'm not saying it's false. I'm saying it's absolutely true. When humans turned against God, immortality was taken off the table. And that's the absolute truth of it. And you might say, well, why did God do that? He created them with this free choice. Why didn't he just let them live forever like that? Well, I think as we read the rest of the Bible, I can suggest a couple of possible reasons. First of all, I think God understood, and his own commitment was, that he was not going to allow evil, even if it became a reality in creation, he was not going to allow evil to continue forever. He would allow it, but he would also put an end date to it. And the rest of the Bible indicates that God has a linear history laid out for creation, which will culminate on the day of Christ's appearing, at which point all humans will face judgment for their lives, and those who have turned to God in faith will be raised and transformed into immortal glory. The imagery of the tree of life reappears in the New Testament as something we now, because of Christ, have access to once more. And creation itself will be remade, and sin will be eradicated from it. So the first reason God didn't let humans live forever is he wasn't going to let sin go on forever. I can think of another reason. Have you read these horrible stories of people who have been imprisoned unjustly and tortured for 40 years before their body finally gave out on them? Can you imagine what kind of horrors we would be doing to each other if people couldn't die? Just how horrible would it be to have a crippling illness that you could never be healed of and you would never be released from? It was a kindness on God's part to give us an opportunity to live a life in which we would have the opportunity to turn to Him and be rescued, but He would not allow the misery to go on forever. It was His kindness that put an end to human lives and gave them a terminus. We have a time to be on this earth and in the midst of the pain of this world to respond to God in faith and be rescued. And that reopens the tree of life. We live in a broken world. The important thing we have to realize is that we are responsible for the current state of the world. Please don't try to tell me it's God's fault. He didn't make our choices. We did. When we turned from God, we made a fearsome adversary of Satan. We broke human relationships and turned them into a power struggle. We made family life a painful experience. We cursed the whole earth. Now it has become a hostile environment in many ways, and we now find ourselves faced not just with honest work, but with anxious toil, hard and often fruitless labor, riddled with anxiety. The good news is that even though this is all our own doing, God has not abandoned us. He helps us understand the truth of our situation so that we can turn to Him and find rescue. In this war against sin and its champion, Satan, God has brought victory through a descendant of Eve, Jesus Christ. He faced the temptation to sin and succeeded where all of us have failed. And He tasted death on our behalf and rose in victory. To Him we may turn in faith and find rescue in this broken world. We're going to sing a song now. And I'm convinced that the Word of God is meant to be a conversation. God is speaking truth to us and calling us to respond to Him. That is why at the end of our service, we have a time of response. A time where you can come forward and say, God, I hear You, and I'm willing to respond to You in faith and surrender. I want to encourage you to take advantage of this time. We will have people here at the front on either side, and I just want you to share with them whatever God's laying on your heart this morning and let them pray with you and encourage you. Let's all stand. Please come while we sing.